This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Please join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Let's talk corruption for a minute. According to Russia Today, between 2000 and 2012, the U.S. government had a deal with a Mexican drug cartel, Sinaloa, that allowed the group to smuggle billions of dollars of drugs in return for information on its rival cartels, according to court documents published by El Universal. Written statements made by a Drug Enforcement Administration agent and a U.S. Department of Justice official in U.S. District Court of Chicago following the 2009 arrest of Jesus Vicente Zambara Niebla, son of a Sinaloa leader Ismael El Mayo Zambara, and the organization's alleged logistic coordinator indicate that the DEA agents met with top Sinaloa cartel officials over 50 times beginning in 2000. El Universal reports the DEA agents met with members of the cartel in Mexico to obtain information about their rivals and simultaneously built a network of informants who signed drug cooperation agreements subject to results to enable them to obtain future benefits, including cancellation of charges in the U.S. Now, just speaking for myself, just you go and traffic an ounce or two of that stuff and see if you can cut a deal that'll cancel your charges. I'll bet you can't. But, you know, smuggle billions of it. Now you're business. Big business. Guess where that money goes? Guess what Citibank depended on during the crash of 08? Could it be drug money? Returning to the article, DEA agent Manuel Castanon told the court, quoting, on March 17, 2009, I met for approximately 30 minutes in a hotel room in Mexico City with Vicente Zambara Niebla and two other individuals, DEA agent David Herod and a cooperating source with whom I had worked since 2005. I did all the talking on behalf of the DEA, end quote. Hours later, Mexican Marines arrested Zambara Niebla, known as El Vicentillo, for trafficking billions of dollars of cocaine and heroin. Castanon and other DEA agents later visited Zambara Niebla in prison, where he reiterated his desire to cooperate. I bet he did. Patrick Hearn, a Justice Department prosecutor at the time, told U.S. District Court that according to DEA Special Agent Steve Fraga, Sinaloa lawyer Castro offered information leading to a 23-ton cocaine seizure, other seizures related to various drug trafficking organizations, and that El Mayo requested his son cooperate with U.S. officials. That's from Russia Today. Find it at RT.com. Now, I put that out as an appetizer for this information, which comes from Narconews.com, an article by Bill Conroy. And the title of it is Pleadings in Federal Court Reveal ICE Undercover Operation Marked with CIA Fingerprints. And it's a long article, and I don't propose to reveal more than a fifth of it at the moment. But just to give you a taste, Conroy writes, federal agents this past November raided the offices of an aircraft brokerage and leasing company called World Jet Incorporated, based in Fort Lauderdale. The raid, spearheaded by U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, was launched on the heels of a DEA affidavit for a search warrant, which was filed in late October last year in federal court in Colorado as part of a case that is now sealed. The search warrant affidavit was made available on the internet after being obtained by a reporter for the Durango Herald newspaper. Hooray for reporters. There's so few left. Returning to the article, the affidavit outlines allegations against several individuals accused by the DEA of participating in a narco-trafficking conspiracy, but that is not the big story here. Instead, the real news is buried deep in the DEA court pleadings and confirms the existence of a U.S. undercover operation that Narco News reported previously had allowed tons of cocaine to be flown from Latin America into the states absent proper controls or the knowledge of the affected Latin American nations. Now, just speaking for myself, tons of cocaine allowed. That's just what I was talking about. And an entirely different, I assume entirely different, article that is in the news today. And You know, it's funny. This sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? But I'll get into that in a minute. Tons of cocaine. Yeah, go ahead. The DEA affidavit focuses on the owner of World Jet, Don Whittington, and his brother Bill Whittington, both of whom earned modest infamy as race car drivers who were convicted and served time in prison for participating in a marijuana smuggling conspiracy in the 1980s. The DEA now alleges that Don and Bill Whittington, through World Jet, have leased or brokered the sale of multiple aircraft to agents of known narco-trafficking organizations in Latin America. Now, I'm going to skip ahead a bit. This article is definitely worth reading through for the details. But they write, Don Whittington's World Jet brokered the Gulfstream II, brokered a Gulfstream II sale to a company called Donna Blue Aircraft. According to the DEA affidavit indicates that Donna Blue was in fact a front company for an ICE undercover operation dubbed Mayan Jaguar. Donna Blue subsequently sold the Gulfstream II jet to a Florida duo, Clyde O'Connor and Gregory Smith, who have a history of involvement in U.S. government operations. About a week later, on September 24th, 2007, the Gulfstream jet crashed. Isn't it funny, departing from this article, how often those crashes kind of reveal something? And I'll be talking about that in a minute. The Gulfstream jet crashed in Mexico's Yucatan with a payload of some 4 tons of cocaine on board. Whoops. Media reports at the time and European investigators, it turns out, have linked the Gulfstream II's tail number in 98S7SA to pass CIA flights to Guantanamo Bay. Narco News reported on the Gulfstream II jet crash and its aftermath extensively and has uncovered documents and sources indicating that Gregory Smith was in fact a contract pilot who did work for the U.S. government, including U.S. Customs, later rolled into ICE, which is part of Homeland Security, DEA, FBI, and likely CIA. A Narco News story published in December 2007 also revealed that the Gulfstream II jet was part of an ICE undercover operation called Mayan Express. From that story in Narco News, the Gulfstream II jet that crash-landed in the Mexican Yucatan in late September 2007, carrying close to 4 tons of cocaine, was part of an operation being carried out by a Department of Homeland Security agency. DEA sources have revealed to Narco News the operation, codenamed Mayan Express, is an ongoing effort spearheaded by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, the sources claim. The information surfaced during a high-level meeting at DEA sources familiar with the meeting assert. Those same sources now tell Narco News that Mayan Express and ICE's Mayan Jaguar operation revealed in the recently filed DEA affidavit are one and the same. A Narco News story about Mayan Express also revealed that, according to several U.S. law enforcers, the operation likely was run with CIA assistance and may well have been a CIA covert operation using ICE as cover for its activities. Now, I was saying this sounds familiar, doesn't it? And I was just talking about Gary Webb the other day after thinking about Michael Harrington and his mysterious exploding car. Gary Webb, a talented journalist who, as I have said, was so talented that he could shoot himself in the head after shooting himself in the head. Suicide, yeah. Shades of Alfred W. McCoy. Shades of Gary Webb's exposés of the Contra Cocaine CIA Drugs and Thugs Network. I would say look it up, but you know, it's not as easy as that. I thought I would just, I'll just go back and refresh my memory. Oh man, you come across a lot more baloney on that than you do the truth. But do remember this, Alfred W. McCoy, The Politics of Heroin. When that book came out, it was an update of a 1972 book by Alfred W. McCoy, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. And if I remember correctly, it was reviewed here on KBOO. And now it's a rather rare book. Why? Because the government bought up the publishing house after it came out. And there was no second edition, even though it was a wildly popular book. I would say this news from Narco News is confirmation that the CIA is as corrupt as ever, 40 years after Air America, a CIA subsidiary, trafficked heroin from Laos. And I looked around on this. Indeed, NBC Miami ran a story in November about DEA raid at the Fort Lauderdale World Jet compound, but no further information has come forth and wouldn't have if it weren't for narconews.com, narconews.com. Worth looking at. All right, I think it's time to talk radiation. I'll just fire up my cheap Geiger counter here. This Geiger counter consistently reads below other Geiger counters, and I suspect that is because its case is rather thick, and I don't see how very much beta gets through it. And right now, I was floating it out the window of the car as it came to the studio. People probably wondered if I was taking their picture or something. And it was registering a mere 14 counts per minute. So beta blocker or not, the radiation isn't too high today, I'm glad to say. And right here in the studios of KBOO, it's barely ticking at all. As a matter of fact, I've yet to hear a tick just the last few seconds. Come on, tick. There's a tick. All right. And this from FukushimaDiary.com. 5,100,000 becquerels per square meter of strontium-90 were measured from groundwater last August, but TEPCO, the corporation that runs the Japanese nuclear power plant wreckage, didn't publish the data for 5 months. For the press's question about why TEPCO doesn't publish strontium-90 data from seawater and groundwater analysis, TEPCO explained that it's because they found technical errors in some of the analysis data. On the 15th of this month, TEPCO released the concealed strontium-90 data along with the wrong analysis data. The newly published data reveals the fact that TEPCO was aware of significant strontium-90 contamination in groundwater and seawater. Except for the samples still under analysis for 6 months, TEPCO measured strontium-90 from all the groundwater samples taken from the seaside of reactors 1 and 2. The highest reading was 5,100,000 becquerels, as I was saying. This is 94 times as much as the former highest reading measured last May. Also, strontium-90 was measured from 97% of seawater samples taken in Fukushima plant port. So I have no doubt. That's 97 times higher than the former highest reading measured last June. So the cover-up goes on. And strontium is very much a word that should be in your mind along with cesium. It ain't just cesium. Well, and it ain't just cesium and strontium, but strontium gets into your bones. It's dangerous stuff. This from WUSA9.com. Attorney Paul Garner, who is representing more than 70 sailors from the Ronald Reagan, who are now experiencing medical issues, says the Tokyo Electric Power Plant Company, the TEPCO, misled the U.S., quoting, "I think TEPCO lied to the world, and our government sent these people in there on a humanitarian mission without consideration of whether or not they were sending these people into a zone where they had a nuclear explosion," end quote. The USS Ronald Reagan, in case you hadn't heard, sailed into the cloud from the exploded reactors. The sailors reported seeing something like snow falling and experienced a strong metallic taste as they went through the cloud. Attorney Paul Garner lists the issues his clients are now facing. Quote, thyroid cancer, brain cancers, gynecological bleeding, growths on their body, hair falling out in clumps, loss of vision, destruction of the immune system, end quote. And of course, U.S. government says, oh, there wasn't enough radiation to harm anyone. Let the Ronald Reagan sailors beware, the horror is just beginning. Their children will suffer the fate of the progeny of Fallujah, struck with nuclear reactor uranium bullets 10 years ago. The photographs of their horrifically mutated babies will give you nightmares if you dare to pull them up on the web, so go ahead, pull up KBOO.fm. I put one of them up. A horrible thing to do, because we live in a horrible world in some ways, and I think there's been altogether too much denial. If you really look, actually, let me tell you how to look for those photographs. Pull up Google Image and then pull up another tab and leave Google Image alone. And then put Fallujah baby into Google Translate and translate it into Arabic. Copy and paste the Arabic. Paste it into a Google Image search. Then you will see the babies. What happened in Fallujah 10 years ago this April? Well, it had a lot to do with depleted uranium bullets. It had a lot to do with white phosphorus rounds. But here's a hint from a relief convoy that arrived shortly thereafter. This was originally printed in the Socialist Worker UK, titled Fallujah, the Truth at Last. Dr. Salam Ismail took aid to Fallujah in May 2005. He reported, "It was the smell that first hit me, a smell that is difficult to describe and one that will never leave me. It was a smell of death. Hundreds of corpses were decomposing in the houses, gardens, and streets of Fallujah. Bodies were rotting where they had fallen, bodies of men, women, and children, many half eaten by wild dogs. A wave of hate had wiped out 2/3 of the town, destroying houses and mosques, schools, and clinics. This is the terrible and frightening power of the U.S. military assault." The accounts, he wrote, that he had heard over the next days would live with him forever. He wrote, "You may think you know what happened in Fallujah, but the truth is worse than you could possibly have imagined." In Saklawiya, one of the makeshift refugee camps that surround Fallujah, we found a 17-year-old woman. She told Dr. Salam Ismail that her name was Huda Fazwa Salam Isawi, and she was from Fallujah. She said, "Five of us, including a 55-year-old neighbor, were trapped together in the house in Fallujah when the siege began. On the 9th of November, American Marines came to the house. My father and the neighbor went to the door to meet them. We were not fighters. We thought we had nothing to fear. I ran into the kitchen to put on my veil, since men were going to enter the house and it would be wrong for them to see me with my hair uncovered. This saved my life. As my father and neighbor approached the door, the Americans opened fire on them. They died instantly." She said, "Me and my 13-year-old brother hid in the kitchen behind the fridge. The soldiers came into the house and caught my older sister. They beat her, then they shot her, but they did not see me. So then they left, but not before they had destroyed our furniture and stolen the money from her father's pocket." Huda told Ismail how she had comforted her dying sister by reading verses from the Quran. After 4 hours, her sister died. For 3 days, Huda and her brother stayed with their murdered relatives, but they were thirsty and had only a few dates to eat. They feared the troops would return and decided to try to flee the city, but they were spotted by a U.S. sniper. Huda was shot in the leg. Her brother ran but was shot in the back and died instantly. "I prepared myself to die," she said, "but I was found by an American woman soldier, and she took me to a hospital." She was eventually reunited with the surviving members of her family. And Dr. Salam Ismail also wrote, "Back in 2005, I also found survivors of another family from the Jolan district. They told me that at the end of the second week of the siege, U.S. troops swept through the Jolan. The Iraqi National Guard used loudspeakers to call on people to get out of houses carrying white flags, bringing all their belongings with them. They were ordered to gather outside near the Jamaat ul-Furqan Mosque, in the center of town. On the 12th of November, Latif and 8 members of his family, one of them a 6-month-old child, gathered their belongings and walked in single file as instructed to the mosque. When they reached the main road outside the mosque, they heard a shout. They could not understand what was being shouted. Ayad said it could have been now in English. Then the firing began. U.S. soldiers appeared on the roof and the surrounding houses and opened fire. Ayad's father was shot in the heart and his mother in the chest. They died instantly. 2 of Ayad's brothers were also hit, one in the chest and one in the back. 2 of the women were hit, one in the hand and one in the leg. Then the snipers killed the wife of one of Ayad's brothers. When she fell, her 5-year-old son ran to her and stood over her body. They shot him dead too. Survivors made desperate appeals to the troops to stop firing." Talking about Fallujah, talking about that glorious victory. "But Ayad told me that whenever one of them tried to raise a white flag, they were shot. After several hours, he tried to raise his arm with a flag, but they shot him in the arm. Finally, he tried to raise his hand, so they shot him in the hand. The 5 survivors, including the 6-month-old child, lay in the... The next morning, the brother who was shot in the neck also managed to crawl to safety. They all stayed in the house for 8 days, surviving on roots and 1 cup of water, which they saved for the baby. On the 8th day, they were discovered by some members of the Iraqi National Guard and taken to the hospital in Fallujah. They heard the Americans were arresting any young men, so the family fled the hospital and finally obtained treatment in a nearby town. They did not know in detail what happened to other families who had gone to the mosque as instructed, but they told me the street was awash in blood." And the writer, Ismail, writes, "I had come to Fallujah in January as part of a humanitarian aid convoy funded by donations from Britain." And, there's much more of that. The number to call with your comments, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, talking about the massacre of Fallujah. And the reason I'm bringing it up is this year marks the 10th year since the massacre, which I don't know how many people were killed, but it was a massacre. It was grotesque. It was anti-civilian. White phosphorus was rained on civilians. Depleted uranium was used against them. Their babies are now mutated. There's all kinds of disease related to depleted uranium happening there and amongst the troops who shot the stuff because, it makes a vapor when you shoot it. And denial does no one any good because the world, anyone who cares, just about anyone who speaks Arabic, I should think, knows about Fallujah. And it can't be hidden. And it is a big reason why the U.S. will not win, and will not win in Afghanistan, will not win anywhere in the Middle East, because the gig is up, how Americans act. And it all started when in 04, when several Blackwater mercenaries, then Z, then Academy, that company is now, I forget what that academy is called now, maybe it's still Academy, were caught doing their nasty things in town and were shot to death, burned, and hung upside down on the bridge. And the U.S. military decided it would teach Fallujah a lesson about opposing the U.S. military. And we say how well it was worked. All the Iraqis got the message that they'd better keep fighting to the death. Wasn't the message intended, but they did get the message. Time is 9:23. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and LJ is on the air.
Hi, Teresa. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. Listen, can we back up for a second about the Fukushima Daiichi?
All right.
And did you want to talk about the American sailors that are now dreadfully ill? I heard this on KBOO, who were helping out with the rescue.
Yes, I just gave a report from their lawyer.
And I'm wondering if you think this is going to be another Agent Orange cover-up by the Pentagon.
Oh, yeah,
I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, well, yeah, it obviously already is. The U.S. government is dragging their feet and wants to pretend that nothing really bad has happened to the sailors of the Ronald Reagan. And their lawyer begs to differ. They're pretty sick. And the way that they are sick is kind of horrifying. But it's also familiar, as I was saying, because of Fallujah. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Talking about the massacre of Fallujah, talking about the USS Ronald Reagan. And speaking of militarization, Richard Huggis wrote an article in Global Research about drone aircraft. He writes, drone aircraft, which we first heard of as weapons of war used by the United States in foreign lands, are now poised for a full-scale invasion of the skies above the U.S. itself. On December 30th, 2013, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration announced its choices for drone testing in six states around the country: Alaska, Nevada, New York, North Dakota, Texas, and Virginia. These six states may in turn do their testing in more than one location. For example, according to the Anchorage Daily News, drone testing centered in Alaska at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks will be called the Pan-Pacific Unmanned Aircraft Systems Test Range Complex. It includes six flight ranges in Alaska, four in Hawaii, and three in Oregon. You ever get up early in the morning and you hear something going around in a circle just above the cloud cover? Gee, I wonder what that could be. Maybe it's a Cessna pilot who's so bored that he loves to get up every morning at 5 a.m., and drive in a circle, fly in a circle around Portland. And maybe it's a drone. Can't say that I really know. But you heard it here. Oregon is included. And why wouldn't they put a drone over a little Beirut, Portland, Oregon? According to the East Oregonian, drone testing is likely to involve a former military base in Pendleton, Port of Tillamook, and Warm Springs. Likewise, the New York operation will be run from the former Griffiss Air Force Base in Rome, New York, and according to Cape Cod Times, will also include the former Otis Air Base on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. The Times reports that the Cape site had the support of the state's congressional delegation, a statewide military asset commission, and the business leaders. Oh, there's money involved. Oh, yeah. Almost as good as oil, which you can turn into money. So, there's more on that article. Find it at Global Research. Article on Washington's blog on Global Research says the government has sought to reassure us that it is only tracking metadata, such as the time and place of phone calls and not the content of the calls. There is substantial evidence from top whistleblowers that the government is recording the content of the call word for word, and former CIA deputy director and White House NSA spying panel member Mike Morrell says that metadata is content. But even accepting the government's claims at face value, technology experts say that metadata can be more revealing than the content of your actual phone calls. For example, Ars Technica notes the ACLU filed a declaration by Princeton computer science professor Edward Felton to support its quest for a preliminary injunction in that lawsuit. Felton, a former technical director of the FTC, has testified to Congress several times on technology issues, and he explains why metadata really is a big deal. There are already programs that make it easy for law enforcement and intelligence agencies to analyze such data, like IBM Analyst Notebook. IBM offers courses on how to use Analyst Notebook to understand metadata, call data, better. Unlike the actual contents of calls and emails, the metadata about those calls often can't be hidden, and it can be incredibly revealing. Sometimes more so than the actual content. Knowing who you're calling reveals information that isn't supposed to be public. Inspectors general at nearly every federal agency, including the NSA, have hotlines through which misconduct, waste, and fraud can be reported. Hotlines exist for people who suffer from addictions to alcohol, drugs, or gambling, for victims of rape, domestic violence, people considering suicide. And text messages can measure donations to churches, Planned Parenthood, or a particular political candidate. Felton points out what should be obvious to those arguing it's just metadata, the most important piece of information in these situations is the recipient of the call. More on that article. Find it on Washington's blog on Global Research. You've been listening to Press Watch. Stay tuned because Parafoggering is coming up and more of KBOO's public affairs broadcasting on KBOO Portland and all the ships at sea.
Such large numbers. KBOO Radio is proud to sponsor Keep Alive the Dream 2014, the 29th annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This annual event, a production of World Arts Foundation Incorporated, will be broadcast live from the Anthem Convention Center at 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in its entirety on KBOO on Monday, January 20th from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side under Community Events.
It's hard to think that this great man is dead.
Mo is Shy, the KBOO docudrama based on the Portland Christmas tree trial, airs this January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. Here's FBI undercover agent Hussein by Ross Freeman Levin.
We started with small talk. It was important to get him to like me so we could get all the facts. Then the defendant came up with the target of Pioneer Square. He came up with the idea to get a truck full of explosives and blow people up at the tree lighting ceremony on November 26th.
January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Well, good morning. This is Parafoggering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, author of several books. Most recent book is The Race for What's Left. And he writes a lot of articles and that can be found in the Tom Dispatch, which is a wonderful website. I recommend it, the Tom Dispatch. So, Michael Clare, welcome to KABU.
My pleasure. Always to be there with you.
Yes. Well, you know, this has been a kind of a, the title of your most recent article is Have the Obits for Peak Oil Come Too Soon? We've been seeing a lot of obits in the last year. It's been a big year for the Evermore crowd. So what's going on?
Well, you know, a year ago, your listeners may recall, the International Energy Agency in Paris, that's the IEA, released a study announcing that the U.S. would overtake Saudi Arabia to be the world's leading oil producer around 2020. And then when you combine Canadian production by around 2030, North America would be a major energy exporter, not importing oil anymore, but an exporter. And all of this tied up with hydrofracking and tar sands and all kinds of new technology was going to create a new era of energy abundance. And so peak oil, or the notion of oil decline, is out the window. The new reality is energy abundance, and it's going to last for some time to come. So what the pundits were saying is peak oil is dead.
Well, you know, this has really kind of burned me up over the year because they keep talking about all this oil in the ground, and they never say anything, or very rarely say anything, about how expensive it will be. And they don't talk about how much energy it takes to get that oil. You know, like the first oil well in this country where they found oil at 69 feet in Pennsylvania. You know, now they go miles under the ocean and horizontal drilling and fracking and tar sands. And that's bound to cost a lot of money and consume a lot of energy.
Exactly right. And more importantly, I think, involves a great deal of environmental risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because to extract that, you have to use a lot of force, a lot of aggression to